So this is about looking down. A lot of space that we're hearing about and working on is up in space, but Earth observations is fundamentally about looking down. In 2009, the Academies of Science published a report saying that Earth observations from space were the single most important source of environmental information for Australia. That includes things like the weather, none of which will work half as well without observations from space that are taken routinely, globally, and feed into the weather models. Alan Smart, who's in the audience here today and was on an earlier panel, has put an estimated value on Earth observations from space for Australia as part of our planning work and how that's growing into the future, and that's in the billions. So it's a significant investment, and it's one of the reasons that the Australian government has invested itself in Earth observations. As I said, I'm Adam Lewis from Geoscience Australia. I've been in Australian Earth observation since at least 2005, working on how we make better use of our data. Most recently, that's come to fruition through the government funding Digital Earth Australia, which is something we created and worked with CSIRO to develop and is now going international. So it's fundamentally about how the government uses Earth observation. I'll come back to that in a moment. So the question I thought we should focus on is one that's recurred over at least since 2005 to now and continues. And it continues around a whole range of fora that I get involved with nationally and internationally. And that is, what is the role of government versus the private sector in Earth observation in Australia? What looks good? What works? What doesn't work? And some of our participants, most of them, have experience internationally. And so we can look at what that experience might show. We have in the room the Australian Space Agency, who are going to be very interested in this, how they take Australia forward as an industry. And we've got an opportunity here to set Australia on a good path in terms of what works between government and industry in enabling Earth observation and space going forward. Right, I'll start off by this. Over 10 years or more, we've worked out good documents about the value of Earth observation from space. We've built capabilities and had them funded for the government to generate better value from Earth observations from space. I'm a government guy. We're building workflows that extract information that are helping to manage the Murray-Darling Basin better and giving us methods to detect changes in our coastlines. We're working with government departments to do that, to modernise government. We're also putting those data in a place where industry can better access this publicly available data to innovate on it and make additional products. So my question, and I'm going to throw this to Rob, is, so what am I doing wrong, Rob? What am I doing?
I don't think I've ever said publicly you're doing anything wrong, but I think GA's come a long time. I mean, Adam and I have known each other for many, many years, and I've known GA for many years. And the whole debate that we're hearing recently is, you know, sovereign capability, industry engagement, sustainability, you know. So how are we going to do that? And I often ask people, how are you going to build industry capability? I see I'm part of the industry. How are you going to build my capability? And certainly one of the things that I love to use as an example is, recently I was fortunate enough last year actually to go to the US on a trade mission, and we went to NASA. And just about everybody, I see most of the people that were on that mission are here actually, and just about every facility we went to, when we talked to a government person, the government person said, and I asked them that question, the government person would say to me, if industry can do it, government doesn't do it. If industry has the capability, we don't go there. And I think that's a really good model to follow in actual fact. The trouble is, Australian industry, you know, doesn't have that capability yet. But if you keep ignoring Australian industry, we'll never have that capability. And so I think a really easy thing to do, and certainly GA has come a long way, and I think they're doing it now in actual fact with some projects, is to engage Australian industry, see what our capability is, try us. And it may not be the best capability, and it may not be the cheapest capability, but you're building a capability for the long term. And so if the message is anything, it's try Australian capability. And in many cases, I said earlier, you know, 75% of our business is government and the rest is commercial. If there's a project that you think you can do, but you think Australian has the capability, I'm not saying that you give out free money to industry, but go to open tender and try and get Australian companies to respond. I think that's how you can do it. I'm not asking for free handouts.
Thanks, Rob. So another angle on this is that things are changing. I guess I'd like to throw to Rick and maybe Michael about what's changing in the global context that's actually affecting the way in which we source Earth observation capabilities and the relationship between government and industry in that. And I guess you could start with, I mean, Planet's an obvious player on that.
Yeah, so that very much fits into the space 2.0 that gets thrown around but may not necessarily resonate with everyone what it means. But a large part of it for Planet is agile space, this idea that you're adopting agile methodologies. And what that means is you react, try and fail fast. So that's a systems engineering term, but it's been adopted by the startup industry as a metaphor for what they're trying to do. They want to get capability out there, see how the market reacts, respond to feedback, and then deploy that into the next iteration of what they put out. Planet are able to do that because they're building CubeSats. The space industry supports that now with a lot of launches, a lot of ability to get small sats up there quickly so that we can respond to feedback. Now, the important part there is the feedback. Share what you want to try and achieve, and share what you're trying to achieve from a business sense. Don't talk about the technology that you want to use. Talk about what it is you want to achieve at a business level, and let the people that put the technology together look at what's already available, look what can be developed, feed that into their systems, or try the systems out and feed back and say, well, this doesn't work, or this works. That's what Agile is all about, and it's part of, they call it the lean startup. The lean startup is all about putting something out there, see how it works, see what doesn't work, and change that, change your systems because you're customer focused. And that's what new industry is all about, is being customer focused, and you as the customer are the ones that make that work.
So I want to dovetail onto that, if you don't mind, for just a second. Part of it is there is the art of the possible. You know, what can we do? And then the other part is the education part. And that's our responsibility in industry to reach out to governments and to universities and help them understand the capabilities of these sensors that we've deployed and what can be done with some of those things. For instance, this goes back to us looking at the VIRS instrument that we fly on two of our spacecraft right now, and we discovered that we were able to do pretty precise ship tracking. And that has been incredibly useful for the United States Coast Guard and for the government of Indonesia, because we've developed entire capabilities for them to be able to monitor and interdict missions where there are people doing illegal fishing, because we can see at night with 375-meter resolution, and each pixel is geolocated. So when somebody turns off their VMS system, we can still see them transiting, and we get kind of a gross sense of heading since we make a pass over them about once every 50 minutes. So we can kind of make a deterministic look as to what path we think they're going, what the speed or rate they have across the ocean. So if we were able to get into the right meetings, colloquiums, forums, we could come in and talk about the capability that's already resonant, that's in the constellation, that's already, the data's already revealed for free, that could be used. And then if we heard your problem sets, we could say, here's a way to solve this. It doesn't necessarily sell another sensor for Raytheon, but it makes a better use of the taxpayer dollar.
So that's actually quite a different perspective to the procurement perspective, which in a sense, where Rob came from, was to say, at least try local industry when you're procuring. You're actually saying industry need to be in the discussion about what's required going forward and be promoting some of the solutions, and that seems.
Well, I think that there's things that we could reveal as the manufacturer, as the industry, that it just may not be as obvious to end users, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we had the ability to kind of reach out and talk about what those capabilities were, I think we could find ways to more smartly utilize those resources already there, and then it would also help us when we're going forward. If there are some gaps that we identify, we can build that into the next round of capability that we're going to put on orbit.
Mike, did you have a...
I'd like to pick up on the original question about what should government do and what should industry do. Mm. And in my view, government should do those things for which there is a significant benefit for a wide diversity of the population or the industry or the multiple players involved, where there's a scenario of the individual capability or the individual investment wouldn't be feasible if it wasn't aggregated across this diverse user group.
So infrastructure-type work.
Infrastructure-type work. And a good example is the SBAS that Geoscience is managing at the moment. That wouldn't happen without government funding. But that will put an asset in place which will have spin-off benefits across a whole range of different industries, as demonstrated by the testbed. So we need to think of that scenario in the context of Earth observation and what does it mean for Earth observation. Now, as an outsider coming into the Earth observation business and just reading up briefly about it, I'm actually amazed and impressed by the level of capability in Australia through things like Digital Earth Australia, the Open Data Cube, etc., etc. Some great stuff has been done, some great capabilities have been developed, but as pointed out in a report I read, I think it was the Australian Earth Observation Industry Report or Planning Report, they pointed out the fact that this capability is completely dependent on foreign partners and foreign collaborations for access to the data and access to the space assets. So that's a somewhat tenuous situation. And although it might work in a commercial context, in the military context, it's got some major problems. You know, if you want to, or if you don't want other people to know where you're pointing your satellite and what you're observing, etc., the only way is to have a sovereign space segment and a sovereign ground segment. And Thales is in the position of having helped a number of countries achieve that level of capability. So we'd like to work with Australia to see if we can help achieve that level of capability. You know, Thales has helped Brazil get to a point where they're manufacturing their own telecommunications satellite. Thales has set up a space centre of excellence in Singapore to engage with the research community to look for new disruptive innovations. So there's a number of things that are possible, and I think in the Earth observation area, maybe government should be investing in some of those space-based assets in order to enable the added value companies like Rob's company to get access to data that is more appropriate for his customers.
I think that sovereign capability question is one which I'd like to come to afterwards if we have time, which to be honest we may not have. But I think we've had a couple of really interesting elements there. And I also want to throw to George, because George works with European Space Agency, JAXA, USGS, NOAA, NASA, and others. George, what do you see around the world in terms of the relationship between space agencies and industry that kind of gives us lessons for here, or works and doesn't work?
Well, I think there's a lot of different models. First of all, I would say even between Australia, where I live now, I'm from Australia, but Canada is where I grew up. And it's a completely different model within government, say, between those two places. But I think there's one overriding trend here, and that's the openness of the data has unlocked all kinds of unanticipated applications, and I think it supports that publicly funded data should be, to the maximum extent possible, available and freely distributed, because I think it supports industry, it forms a backbone. And we see that in the European experience. They've opened up their data policies, and the U.S. opened up data policies in Japan. Also, they move slower, but they're in the process of opening up data policies. We're seeing Argentina is building a free and open L-band satellite constellation, first one launched last year. So I think that is a key trend that we need to be looking at, is putting this data out there. And by all means, we need industry to think about how industry adds value. And there's plenty of ways to do that, I think. But the old model where the value add was put the data in a can and pay to get it out, I think is not necessarily the future value add model for industry going forward. And I think that's, we're seeing that around where we work anyway, the areas we work.
So I, in my international sort of meanderings, I think that we in Australia tend to have a fairly mature approach to industry, partly because we have a clear separation and that other countries have different lines, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Do you think we're in a relatively good place or a bad place? I don't want you to name names or give symptoms, but...
As though I can pass judgment somehow? No. I do find things are quite good here, and I think this opportunity, I mean, we see this conference here today, and this is reflecting a bit of a reinvigoration with the new space agency. And, you know, I think people see possibility, and I think we have a chance to not go down some of those blind alleys that previously has happened. There was some interesting comments about, you know, giving Australian industry a go, which I completely agree with. And in the Canadian experience, some of my friends who've worked there have seen there is that policy, and the Canadian Space Agency has a budget to fund programs. On the other hand, the people on the ground who are trying to procure hardware are telling us, you know, it costs twice as much to buy from a Canadian company as the global cheapest option, right? So there are some tricky things that are going to happen, and you open up the floor and you may end up paying more. It's an investment in national capacity, and I think that's the trade, and it should be done consciously. It should be a conscious investment in a national capability rather than you know, just paying twice and forgetting about it.
I'd quite like to go back to the infrastructure theme that, that Mike brought up, that where it makes sense for government to do things that are benefiting a broad range of people. What we've seen in the Earth observation space over the last decade is that the boundary keeps moving between what is a value add rather than just something that everybody can use, if you like. So 10 years ago, my team used to process an image and sell it to a value-added retailer for $1,000, and maybe it's a bit more than 10 years now, and then they would do something with it. Now the boundary has kept moving to the point where we now see it as government business to just generate images that are ready to use. How do we deal with that continually moving boundary of what makes sense to be, of what's a value add, if you like?
So I obviously can't talk to an Australian perspective, but I can, as a bloody Yank, I can talk about the United States, right? So we've entered into treaties with European nations, with Japan, because we see the value in bilaterally sharing the data, right? It would be cost prohibitive for the United States to bear the entire LEO constellation of weather satellites. So what we have done is we've agreed by treaty to share our data freely, and they share their data freely back, and then we do things like provide the common ground system so that we actually will bring their data down at Svalbard, Norway, or we'll bring it down at McMurdo Station, and then we will process and deliver that data to help find additional ways to invigorate the science, right? Because if we're sharing it freely and we're all looking inside, we find new ways to exploit what JAXA's GCOM W1 does, or what UMETSAT's METOP A or METOP B does. Back to Raytheon as an industry partner, we've taken those algorithms and tuned those again to find new ways to reprocess that data to produce new things that protect resources, protect life. The one that I'm most excited about, I shared with you over lunch, is total precipitable water from the VIRS instrument. We can now measure a 375-meter cube of a cloud and tell you how much rain will come out of it. Simultaneously, we use the ATMS instrument to take a moisture content shot at the soil. So now I can tell you when it does rain, how much is going to run off into the tributaries, and how much you're going to see total out of that storm system, and how much that is going to go downstream. So 3 days from now, New Orleans is going to have a flood stage of 3 feet because of rain in Oklahoma. So tuning those algorithms, coming up with ways to do that is critical to us, because it invigorates science from other industries as well.
So you're then being paid for your services to develop algorithms that deliver.
No, we're doing that pro bono. So we're doing that because we built a sensor.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. So going back then, the data is as free and open, and we are seeing in Australia and elsewhere around the world incredible leverage being put to open government data. Rick, how does that sit with planet-type model, where you've also got high volumes of data coming through, but it's commercial imagery data? How do you see that?
It's commercial data, but it's for sale. So if you want to buy it at the right license cost to make it publicly available, then that is a possibility.
So you're comfortable that the boundary is pretty clear between the sorts of things, say, USGS give me for free, and the sorts of things you would sell?
Well, this is what I find interesting. There's a lot of free data that can come through, and then a lot of people put research into calibrating that data to make it usable. Whereas if you're buying the data, you say, hey, I'm paying for this data, I want it in this format. You do that work and give it to me in a format that I can use immediately. And we were talking earlier about machine learning. You need that data in a usable state. to take advantage of machine learning until we get to that point where the data can just be analysed, so analysis ready. We're a long way from taking advantage of machine learning. And I don't know if free data necessarily gets that, because you can't push back and say, well, I got this for free, but it's not in the state that I need it. I need you to do this to it to get it to the state that I need.
Well, there is a synergy between Planet and USGS in terms of cross-calibration of data against a more expensive instrument that Planet have articulated as being a big plus of the public data.
Can I just comment on this? It sounds very similar to a problem that we used to have in sonar, and a guy once said to me, he who has the data is king. Okay? So in this context, if government agencies have more access to the data, it's logical that they start to then extend their business perimeter further downstream, further added value. That's the trend with an industry at the moment, to add value to the data, to enrich the data. So there's a natural tendency for this to happen. And the only way to get around that is actually change the source of the data so that large volumes can come freely, well, not free, but easily, to those innovative small guys who can develop these capabilities. So it's about controlling the flow of data and the source of data, I think.
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I want to talk about free data. I mean, who believes anything's free?
It's not free.
I mean, we may not have a cost associated with getting data from the USGS or somebody, but somebody's paid for the launch of the satellite. Yeah. Somebody's paid for the satellite. So in many cases, when we talk about free data, we're actually saying it's free, but in actual fact, we're just simply offset. Somebody else has actually paid for it, so we're getting a freebie from somebody else. Yeah. But you have to pay for the data. You have to pay for a satellite, and you have to pay for the launch, and you have to pay for the downlink and the processing and everything else. So, you know, if this trend is moving towards getting more free data, to me, free data, like Rick said, is just a licensing issue. I mean, I can sell you imagery, and if you want to give it to everybody, sure. It's just going to cost you more, and somebody down the stream won't have to pay for the data. So they're not paying for the data, but somebody's going to be paying for the data.
So quick comment, and then I want to ask the audience for a question because we're running out of time. The USGS make their data free and open because the return on investment is so much higher than if they charged
Correct.
For it. So from a government point of view, it makes a huge amount of sense. Do we have any questions or comments from the audience at this point? Here we go. Oh, is that Alan?
Adam, I'd like to ask a double-barrel question, perhaps either George or Rob. Firstly, how fast is this market growing? How fast is demand growing? And do we have the skills in our capabilities in our workforce to meet that growth?
Well, I'll start off. Look, I said earlier to somebody, I think the commercial sector has so much potential, and somebody's already touched on it. We need to work collectively. Everybody here, that's government and private enterprise, needs collectively to work to educate the Australian community, both in the commercial sector and all the various markets that we're looking at working in, on the benefits of space. And there are tremendous benefits. I mean, you've done a lot of the work in the cost-benefit analysis for these industries, but there's not a lot of take-up. The take-up is slow, but it is accelerating. It is increasing. We're seeing more and more people coming to us in the industry and saying, I've got a problem, and we have to solve the problem. So we're not selling them data. We're actually selling them an answer to their problem. Okay, so it's all the downstream. But more and more that's happening. We think a satellite can do this, but can you do the analytics? Can you give us, and sometimes it's just an email, or sometimes it's a map or whatever. So I think that commercial sector is growing, and I see it accelerating in actual fact. The government sector, as you know, Scott said earlier, is definitely growing as well, but it's probably growing at a more consistent pace than the commercial sector. But we don't have the skills. You know, when we advertise for people with imagery or geospatial analysis, quite often we get data. You know, kids coming out of university with really strong data analytics skills, which is good. That's good as well, you know. But really, we do a lot of work. Our company does a lot of work with universities and schools. That whole STEM side, lots of people talk about it, but we really need to do things there as well and get kids excited and get kids doing, you know, the sciences. That's very, very important. Otherwise, we'll find in 5 or 10 years' time, when this has really taken off, that we're going to have a big, big vacuum.
Sure, our next challenge.
Yeah, I agree that the demand is growing. It's growing significantly in the commercial sector. And, you know, the comment from the Thales Alenia Space people I talk to, they say, well, the consumer just wants more, they want to cover imagery of everything all the time. And it leads to this new paradigm of looking at data from a time-lapse perspective, like Digital Earth Australia does when it looks at all the variations over time. That's a new perspective. There's bound to be additional innovative perspectives that come out of this data as you get more data, and innovative business models that are developed through having access to that data. One of the problems or challenges that I see, if I'm here to talk on, is the technical issue of applying this technology to large data sets. People are using machine learning technology that requires thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of samples to train stuff. That's not going to work with this data that's actually quite expensive at the source. We need new AI techniques. Talus has just acquired a small startup company in AI that does a thing called GFT, which is genetic fuzzy trees. It's a way of doing machine learning and AI with very small data sets for training. We need to start looking at those sort of innovations to be able to get best value out of the data, which often we haven't got as much as we would like in order to actually train.
John Marshall's my name. I'm the Weather Bureau in Melbourne, but I've actually been director at the NASA and R&D at E Joint Center in Washington and a few other places during my time. I guess my comment is that at the moment, for instance, the average weather service uses instruments that commonly may have 8,000 channels, like EASI, which is an interferometer. We tune those instruments with bending angle from radio occultation measurements to make sure they don't vary. It's quite a complicated business. And a state-of-the-art system has, I guess, 100 data streams. That means every hour or every 6 hours, you use 6 hours' worth of data in four dimensions to work out the basic atmospheric state. And that's not a small undertaking. And it's not really one that AI can do tomorrow either. It's, you know, the radiative transfer equation still has to be solved in a lot of cases. So we're in a position now where for instance, in Australia, where we're reliant on this data stream, which comes from, I guess, a stream of international satellites.
John, and we're kind of running out of time.
Okay, it comes from a stream of international satellites. And I think the Academy of Science, for instance, has recommended that we actually should make a balanced contribution for this. I think one of the... I'm just wondering whether you think that one of the questions we should discuss in Australia is, given our complete dependence on these data for things like tropical cyclone forecasting and so on, that one of the questions we should debate is what sort of strategic contribution we should make to this, and in doing that we should look at how industry would be involved in that. So I think it's a complicated question, but I think the answer to those questions are being asked by the Academy of Science also involve a significant industry contribution.
I relish the opportunity to work with Australia on this. I mean, this is right in my wheelhouse. And frankly, I left a blizzard in Colorado, and I don't know if you've been outside today, but I'm willing to stay as long as you want. Seriously. So you're right. And right now, on the Comprehensive Large Array Stewardship System, which is what we store all of our satellite observations on for weather in the United States, we're putting away something in the order of about 32 petabytes a month, right? So we're putting away an inordinate amount of Earth observation, and what we need is to work with governments and other entities to find out what actionable intelligence you need. If you can tell me what the actionable intelligence is that you need, I can tell you how to matriculate that out and get it to you with low latency and high availability. But I'm not part of that conversation.
Please thank the panel for their time.